you have faith in Field? From the University at Buffalo School of Social Work, welcome to the In Social Work podcast. I'm Peter Sabota. It's good to have you along, everybody. Field practicum, or field placements if you're old school, are effectively the learning lab where MSW students have the opportunity to apply the content, the theory, and skills that they've learned about in coursework, and where they receive mentoring or supervision in a relationship built to foster their professional development. The inclusion of spirituality in social work education and practice has come a long way from something that was there but was avoided to being promoted by the Council on Social Work Education, the ethical practice of social work, and the ability to demonstrate cultural competence. Despite this progress, there are still barriers, or at least reluctance, for students, field educators, and social work educators that impact comfort levels in accessing a supervisory relationship that welcomes and builds on these topics. Our guest, Bailey Nichols, MSW, will share her work interviewing MSW students about their experiences in field practicum supervisory relationships, and especially when the conversation might need to include overt discussions related to spirituality and religion. Ms. Nichols will also discuss ideas related to what behaviors students and supervisors might engage in that not only promote these discussions, but enhance social work education and practice. C. Bailey Nichols, MSW, is a PhD candidate at the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work. Hi, Bailey. Welcome to In Social Work.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. We had 2 days of warm weather here in Western New York, and then it all just started again. So I'm not going to complain too much about that. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We've been looking forward to talking with you. And if you would, before we get going, or before we jump right in, we already kind of did, but if you would you kind of allow me to lay out a couple of assumptions? And I'm actually going to lay out two or three of them. One by one. And if you would you comment on them one by one? And so I'll lay out an assumption, and then I'll stop talking and ask you to respond based on your knowledge and your work around our topic today. So is that fair?
That sounds great.
All right, here we go. Here's number one. Assumption number one. Is it fair to say that the social work literature, at least related to spirituality and religion in social work practice, suggests that if a person, like say a client, for example, is presenting with struggles or difficulties related to their own adherence or practice, or even the appropriateness of their own spiritual religious practice, that in that case, unless the social worker has specific training in spirit, if you will, spiritual counseling, they should probably or should refer that client to someone else, maybe another social worker who does. What do you think?
This is a great and I think a very multi-layered question, because it really just depends on what the client is coming in with. So if we think about it, so, you know, obviously, if you know someone who's trained in this area and you have someone nearby that can address these issues and you know them, absolutely, 100%, like go ahead and refer if you can. I think, though, a lot of times when people are coming in with these issues, it tends to be a little bit more complex. And so with that in mind, you know, some of the clients may be dealing with some trauma. A lot of times, like when you have people coming in the practicum placements, I think that I have heard some students come in with some really complex concerns. And so a lot of that will be dependent on the client. So if a client's coming to a social worker, either they're not aware of folks around who have those qualifications, or they're specifically wanting to talk to the social worker and not necessarily someone who is, you know, if we think about how we're the idea of pulling in religious and or spiritual leaders or resources, there's oftentimes a reason that they're coming to the social worker and not to their pastor, their imam, their the leader of their synagogue, to talk about these kinds of things because they are a little bit more complex, and because a lot of times there is an element of trauma that could be pulled in, or there's an element of where this is intersecting with mental health, and we really do need to go and see a social worker. And so I think that that really speaks to the need for, again, for social workers to be competent in these areas, to know enough to be able to help address some of this. So ideally, yes, if you have a spiritual counselor who can help you, who you know who's available to help address those issues, absolutely do refer. But that should be something that you and the client work with together. I mean, I think it's only fair to lay out as a practitioner like where you can and cannot help address some of these things. But I do think that that a lot of times folks will come to social workers specifically because they're not, you know, in these realms. Because a lot of times the issues that come to social workers are related to, for example, one of the interview participants was talking about their Muslim client who was struggling with divorce and the stigma of divorce. And so adhering to, you know, her religious practices while also navigating something that is really largely stigmatized in their faith tradition, like that's a big thing. And so I think it just really speaks to the need. And again, if you're in rural settings, right, like there's not necessarily going to be somebody that you know that's going to be able to address these, or if they
For
are, they
sure.
have virtual or they're miles away or what have you. And so it just kind of underscores the real importance and the need to gain confidence in this area and to know, and maybe, and again, this is maybe a conversation side bunny trail here, where, you know, it's not necessarily competence. It's not about knowing the things, but the competence comes in the humility and the ability to be curious and ask questions and ask the right questions to help engage the participant as they wrestle through some of their, you know, where they're holding tension between their belief system that they subscribe to and the reality of where they are at the current moment.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. And I think when I was kind of constructing that assumption, I'll tell you exactly what I had in mind. A client comes in to meet with a social worker, and the phone call or the initial contact described like experiences with depression that are just like kind of unshakable. But as you talk with them, what they just do is they relate their depression, or as they call it, and their symptoms to, I'm having a crisis of faith. And they start citing specific aspects of, for example, a religion, and wondering if that's a fit. And really, in the end, what they're really presenting is kind of like this crisis with a particular religion. I mean, pick any. And let's say, even whether the worker perhaps even affiliates with that particular religion or not, but doesn't have training in guiding people through that practice and that exploration, and maybe that, I don't know, clarification process. It sounds like you're saying it would be ideal in that circumstance, perhaps, especially if you don't have expertise or training of your own to refer, to, or try and find somebody who could. Is that accurate?
Yes, ab absolutely. And especially if you have the resources available. But ideally, you know, if folks are grappling with that, you'd have to think about like where is some of this coming from? Is it coming from, you know, some of the messages they're receiving? In which case, because in some cases, depending, but you again, you'd want to have some good judgment to see if you could help make that discernment, you know, help in that discernment process of, well, is this something where, you know, you partner with a religious leader to help address those things together, or is this something that is stemming from okay, my religious leader is telling me these things, and they're
Right.
giving me like they are the origin of this belief system that is now causing depression and a crisis of faith. In which case, that gets to be a little bit more of a complex issue. And
Sure.
then, but ideally, all social workers, hopefully, at some point, will have this training to be able to help people. To be able to help ask the right questions so that the client themselves kind of works through it. And you're just kind of there to help shape their processing.
Sure. All right. So now, and you've kind of addressed this, but I'm going to lay out my second assumption. And so, all right, now let's say a client includes or spends a fair amount of time talking about the role that their faith, religion, or a kind of a spiritual discipline plays in their life, comfort, meaning making, any things like that. Anything like that, rather. Social workers, they should engage in that conversation. In fact, that would actually be an application of cultural competency. And not to say even reflective of the biopsychosocial perspective. What do you think about that one?
Oh, absolutely.
I thought you might
100%.
say that.
Like, this is so, I mean, because ultimately the desire to help, practitioners feel more comfortable and confident in this area is so that we can help our clients. And so this is, and for a lot of clients, this is where they get their main source of support, and their main source of being. And it's a core part of an individual's identity for a lot of clients. And so whether they talk about it or not, it can be, or whatever their worldview is. And maybe we think about it not necessarily as a religion or spirituality, but oftentimes a worldview. That worldview, we're all going to deal with things, in life. Like, what do we do with the fact that like things are just sucky sometimes?
Right.
What is your worldview for how you navigate that? And so I think this is really, really, really important and key, and it should be something that we get comfortable with, just holding that tension to the fact that other people's worldviews are not our worldview, and being curious about it and not being threatened by it. And that gets, and that's where it gets a little dicey, is because we oftentimes do get a little bit uncomfortable when things aren't lining up with our own worldview. And so, but that's what we, as social workers, supposed to be doing. But increasingly in culture, I found it harder and harder to like hold that tension. And so I think that there's such a need as social workers for us to be the ones that kind of help stand in the gap when things are uncomfortable, and to be okay with that discomfort. Because, culturally we start seeing, and I did not mean to bunny trail off into this, but like we're not really great with holding views that are not our own and being able to hold them in tension. Oh my goodness, right? So this is an invitation to personal growth and to being able to hopefully help, remedy one of our culture's kind of biggest, issues. And it can be in this place
Well,
where,
yeah. Yeah, we're
anything.
supposedly the person in environment profession, so you would think that this would be second nature, but I think without doing a deep dive, I think we could probably both, well, I'll try it. We could probably both acknowledge that not all students, not all supervisors, not all social workers or people think it's really appropriate to talk about this with people. There's an element of taboo that I think has gotten a lot better. But it's still prevalent. So now we come to you call that it gets dicey. I call this the juicy and really interesting part because you are asking questions in an area that applies to or that reflects students' experiences of discussing religion and spirituality in the context of their social work education and their relationship with their field educator or supervisor. And so, you are studying and you're having interviews with students and asking them how that goes. So here's the first question, and this is a weird one, if I got that part right. And people can't see us, so you'll have to imagine that there's a smile on my face when I say this. Why? Why are you studying this?
Great question. So people usually say that your research is oftentimes me search. So every research has question has some sort of a personal connection. And so this kind of it was kind of a long journey to get here. I didn't really believe that this was at first when I started my program. I was not planning on studying this at all. I was like, wait a minute, this is, I thought you had to be in a religious school to study this. So I had a whole other plan to, because I'm at the University of Pittsburgh, which is, quite secular. So, I started my journey thinking I would study integrated health. I'm still interested in that. Like as most researchers are, we have like 50 billion things we want to research because we're just curious people and it's exciting. And I love it. But I started working on a project that was faith-based and didn't even, and it just opened my eyes to a world of, wait a minute, I can do research about this stuff? Hold on. Like in a secular school? Wait a minute. Like, so thinking about that, I just know that I did not feel equipped or trained to address some of these issues myself. And so I, in my field placement, I had, sorry, practicum placement. In my practicum placement, I had two great practicum placements. I had one, my first practicum supervisor was wonderful. It was more of a community organizing kind of role. We at Pitt, we separate into community organizing and direct practice. And so it was more of a like, looking at grants and research and that kind of thing. And, it was really great. I felt totally comfortable if I needed to talk about issues related to religion or spirituality with my supervisor. And I, of course, had some reasons that I thought made it more comfortable for when my supervisor, very much was very clear going in where she stood and was willing to talk about it. And it was part of her self-disclosure was right up front. It was like, okay, here, I am a person that, believes X, believes Y. She was very much like, this is who I am. And so I was like, great, I guess I can talk about that here. So this is fine. And it didn't come up, and it didn't really come up much because we were doing the higher level, community organizing stuff, and holding, doing different things with family support centers. It just wasn't
Clinical
necessary.
practice,
Yes.
or yeah.
Exactly. It just wasn't part of the placement. But my second placement was with in a geriatric care center. And so we're dealing with, life stage changes and shifts and body changes and all sorts of things. And so a lot of those, like it did come up quite a bit in that setting. However, I felt very uncomfortable bringing it up to my supervisor in that setting. And I had to bring it up because I had a client who was expressing some very similarly to kind of what you were sharing. In your scenario, I had a client come in and was sharing some beliefs that I thought were contributing to his depression. And so in that case, I was like, well, do I challenge the beliefs? They're his religious beliefs. Do I touch this? Do I not touch this? I'm not sure what to do. And so I knew I had to push through that discomfort and talk to my supervisor. She was great. She handled it like she was very clinical about it. It was wonderful. Like it was fine, but I had so much anxiety bringing up that to my supervisor. And I just thought, if I have this much anxiety, and I'm usually a pretty like, I don't hesitate to ask questions, and I really hesitated to ask that question. So if I had that experience, how many other students were also having that experience? And what do we do to make this more comfortable? Because it is something that needs to come up, and it is taboo, and we're just like, we don't want to touch it with a 5-foot pole because we don't want to offend people. But at the same time, like it could be really helpful to people to have this be part of their treatment. And so yeah, it just was kind of out of my own discomfort. that I was like, what can we do to solve this problem to make this a conversation that's easier to have? Because I think we need to have it, and it will
Sure.
come.
And you know, if I could kind of insert like an anecdotal reflection of mine here. So I've been teaching in an MSW program, been teaching courses since probably 1995. So I've taught a lot of classes, and I've been a full-time faculty member since 2001. I hear regularly, but not always in tremendous numbers, feedback statements from students saying, now this isn't an MSW program, that they don't feel comfortable even raising their own religious or spiritual beliefs in a class. There's no way without a direct invitation they're going to touch that in a field placement. And they actually, I'll even go further, some report hostility, open hostility toward their religious orientation or spiritual orientation when they have tried to talk about it in class. So I think that is to your point, and that rings true for me as well. Now that would be like a whole nother podcast. Maybe we'll do that one, but I think it certainly fits. So now let me, if I could, ask a wide open question. There's going to be lots of room here for you, Maylee. So as you speak with these students about their relationships, you know, talking about religion and spirituality with their field educators or in their field practicums. Ooh, I got that right that time. What, here's the really broad question. If, you know, as best you can, what are you learning? What are they telling you?
Wow.
Yeah.
First thing,
This is an
that's
hour podcast, Bailey. So, yeah.
yes. I'll keep it down.
Well, how about
So
the most popular ones, perhaps? Maybe that
yeah,
would be the,
absolutely. So the first thing I just wanted to just kind of mention is that it really, I was surprised. It really wasn't that difficult to find students who want to talk about this and who want to
Yeah, that
have this
doesn't
conversation.
surprise me, actually.
So I didn't really have too much trouble finding people who wanted to talk with me about it. And it wasn't just people of one, positionality. I had people all over the map. I had atheists and agnostics that wanted to talk about it. I had, Bible believing Christians. And people wanted to talk about it for a while. I had, there were several that went on. There was one transcript that went on for over 2 hours. So just that students are hungry for this opportunity to be able to process something that's very difficult in a safe space. And so the research context is a very safe space for people to be able to process because, I think there's a lot of things that go into field placement, and this has been mentioned in kind of my conversations with students. The power dynamics of being, supervisor or supervisee can lead into some of the discomfort there. This person's grading me in a sense.
Absolutely, you're being evaluated. It's a pretty high stakes if you think about it.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, for sure. And like we put a lot of pressure sometimes on the field, the practicum placement, to be this place where you're getting these on the ground skills, which is why I think that we really, really need to be doing it here and not just in the classroom. So, the classroom can be, I think the field is even more of a critical space because this is where people are doing the application work and are going to have the questions come up more often. If we're thinking about theory in a classroom, that's very different than on the ground with clients. And so making this a safe space is just so critical. And so thinking about that, so number one, students want a safe space to talk about it. I think number two, students want and need the invitation to talk about it with that in mind. So it's
Invitation,
important,
you said.
an invitation. So I think having an invitation, it doesn't necessarily mean that the students are going to necessarily take it, but I think having an invitation to discuss this could be really helpful. But because this is taboo, there's a lot of fear in bringing it up. And I think we might get to this a little bit later, but there's a lot of topics that are uncomfortable to talk about. And so there is some fear about not being politically correct, and there is a need to break some of the stigma. And so thinking about how we do this, I guess thirdly, just thinking through some of the things I'm learning, people have different opinions on how this should be done. So about 45% of my survey respondents were saying, "Hey, I really want to be the one to bring this up." And usually about 45% of them are the ones actually bringing it up as well. A lot of my students who I talked to were bringing it up in their to their supervisors and talking about the process of how nerve-wracking it was to bring it up. Very similar to my own experience of I was really nervous. I had all these thoughts. I had all these worries. I wasn't sure how she was going to take it. It ended up being fine. I ended up getting educated. This was really helpful. I was glad I did. But getting over that initial, nerves, those initial nerves and that initial pause that like society puts in, there's all sorts of barriers to being able to have these conversations. And so that was something that, when we think about that, how do we make this, inviting for other people? So we had 15. So thinking about I'm kind of switching to my survey. So I did a survey and interviews. So with my survey, I had roughly 15% said that their supervisor brought it up to them and was the one.
15, you said
It
1-5.
15, one
Gotcha.
five. So a very small percentage said that their supervisor was the one that initiated. That some of them said they were more or less equally. So about 40% were more or less equally, but 23% said that they wanted their supervisor to bring it up. So we have people who want their supervisor to be able to invite them into these conversations, and supervisors are not necessarily doing that at the same level. And so there's a real need to help equip supervisors to initiate these conversations in a way that students feel not threatened, but invited to be part of that process. And so there are ways that we can do that. So reflective journaling is something that we, is brought up in the literature, and students seem to think that that could be a good medium to facilitate those conversations. I have all sorts of ideas moving forward about like what we can do to kind of test this out and see what we can do to help facilitate these conversations and maybe think about policies that could help that.
Can I ask just a like a really naive question? Reflective journaling. Would that be shared in your vision with the field educator?
So that's a good question. So one of the limitations to my survey is I didn't specify exactly what reflective journaling was. I didn't provide a definition. I think moving forward, if I were redoing this, I would provide a definition that would say I would bring this up. It would be a reflective journal that was shared with my supervisor and we talked about it. That was the model that was reflected in the literature. There was an article, Jensen Hart, I believe, that talked about dialogue journaling. And it was a 2014 article, and she stepped they stepped through what it looked like with one student to kind of have this religious spiritual conversation through, the student journaling and the supervisor responding, in written form to the journaling questions. So they weren't necessarily engaging with those with that in person necessarily, but it kind of, I think it can provide a jumping off point if something needed to be discussed more more in person.
You've alluded to this, and you've kind of given, you talked about signaling, and I guess as you talk about what you're learning, I'm thinking about, and I'll go back to ask you what you're learning, so don't worry. But I'm wondering, as you're talking with students, are you also talking with the field educators or just the students?
This is just the
Just the
students,
students. Okay. All right.
just for now.
So I'm wondering about if you have any thoughts about the takeaways as yet. And I'm wondering, like, based on what you're hearing, do you have some opinions and thoughts about what else supervisors can do, perhaps even in the most practical ways, that would create a supervisory relationship related that includes discussions of spirituality and religion, where they're not only broached to begin with, but they are actually found beneficial and helpful by actually both parties. I mean, obviously the supervisory relationship should serve the supervisee primarily, but do you have any thoughts on that yet?
Definitely. I think this is one of those things that, as I have been talking to students pay attention to everything. I want to start with that. Students are watching everything. And so what you don't realize you're doing when you're doing your supervision stuff or you're busy with a client, everything that you're doing, students are taking in. And so how you respond to clients, how you respond to other people in the agency, how you respond to time pressures, how you respond, which not just like, not to put too much pressure on, but at the same time, students are watching. And so how supervisors go about their daily life is going to help facilitate or create either a safe place or an unsafe space. And so students have shared, it's not necessarily how, religion and or spirituality that like is what makes like that topic itself is not necessarily the issue. It's did they create an environment where the student felt that they could ask questions, they had time. I think one of the big things is to make time. Students will feel safe and able to sort through things if the instructor makes time to sit with them. So a lot of, I had several students who mentioned lack of time as being a barrier to being able to have these conversations because they didn't necessarily, have the time to really go into depth in their supervision. Whereas another one of my students talked about the supervisor stepping them through a particular religious trauma and helping them process some of that in that time and space. And so having the time available is huge. And that's something that every supervisor can do for the most part, depending on your agency and depending on the demands that are on you and your agency. If you have time to make that time, that can be huge. So, and students are watching. I think the big key, students need to know that you're not judging. Like there needs to be, and oftentimes it's, and the students, as they were sharing with me, were saying, hey, it's basically the kindness with which they responded, the way, I mean, it's kind of basic human decency here. what it comes down to is, are you asking questions? Are you inviting them in? Some students really do want to be invited in. And so particularly around religion and spirituality, inviting them to share, and again, if supervisors are feeling like if they're able to ask some more implicit assessment questions, like, how is this client finding meaning? Like, and then that can be a doorway without being like, is this client religious and/or spiritual? But kind of like, modeling that even in your conversations with the students, giving them an opportunity to share kind of, well, okay, so this client might find meaning this way and you're grappling with this. How are you finding meaning? Like being able to invite them into some more reflective processes by their own curiosity and by modeling, that kind of and we're assuming at this point that this is a clinical setting, but again, that modeling is really key, being able to
Oh,
model.
absolutely. And just talking with students, it's not unusual for there to be, a certain level of almost hero worship or idolization if they really admire, for example, their field educator. So it just adds incredible weight to all of the things that you're talking about, and responsibility on the part of the field educator.
Oh, for
I'm
sure.
also thinking that what probably would be pretty helpful for in terms of field educators again is being able to just kind of, what would it be? To kind of communicate a kind of nuanced level of empathy where the educator is able to express like acceptance and value to what the person is saying, without necessarily agreeing and saying that this is the greatest thing in the world. And although that sounds simple, I think that's harder to do for, I'll say that's harder to do for me And I would think probably a lot of other folks as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let me just flip it a little bit, slightly, my question. So in a very kind of similar vein, are there things that social work students slash interns can do to promote these conversations happening and being beneficial? You spoke a little bit about this, but I'd like to hear more if you have some more.
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing is to be brave and to actually come in and to say, and that's easier said than done. So one of the ways that students can do this is to communicate with the instructor how they learn best. And so it's important to say, like, okay, hey, like maybe my learning style is, I do better with, written processing. So I would like to use journaling as we, engage with one another. So that can be something that, again, students can do, but I think a big key is helping to empower students. And so a lot of times students come into placements and they don't know what they can and can't do. And I know I
Oh, yeah.
certainly felt that way. It's like, well, I don't even know. I just show up at the agency. What do I do? And that's a key thing where policy can play a big role in terms of like what that field, because a lot of times folks are going to have a practicum placement, like practicum class that kind of is supposed to go alongside that. So that's where, our practicum class that I experienced was a lot of, hey, here are some general topics that we think could be helpful. Also, like, let me give you some space to kind of ask questions if you have them about practicum. But I think really orienting folks before they walk into practicum, like, here's what you can and can't, like, here's general guidelines for behavior. Here's how, here's what you can expect. Because none of us, like, we just waltzed in and we just didn't know what to expect. And a lot of times I think that's very much what students.
Yeah, and I think what I'm hearing, and back to the way that I kind of frame the question, is that students don't know, have to know what these things are, perhaps, but it sounds like it would be great if they asked upfront, what do I need to know? What do you have this written down? Is what is the culture? What are the norms here? What are what is realistic? And to just take that initiative, students would be wise to do that.
Yes, absolutely. So I think in addition to that, so like being able to communicate, with instructor is really important and ask those questions. So I think that's where practicum
Gotcha.
can be helpful to students. Like you can ask these questions. These are questions you can and should ask. Another thing that students really should be invited into is engaging in some of their own internal cognitive behavioral therapy. Like thinking through, okay, I'm afraid to ask this question. Why am I afraid to ask this question? What's the worst thing that could happen if I ask this question? And like doing some internal work as to why it's a barrier. And so with that, knowing that if you're gonna make mistakes, now's the time to do it. Like when if we think about it, maybe you get a 3 instead of a 4 or 5 on your, competency score. But if you're going to do that, honestly, like for the sake of the clients, now's the time to do it. And then I think at the same time, also being teachable and giving your instructor the benefit of the doubt. I think instructors do oftentimes have a lot of barriers to having these conversations as well. And so definitely trying to assume good motives of your instructors. I think it's easy. Oftentimes, and as I was hearing students talk, it's easy to assume negative motives sometimes when you're in a position of lower power. But also like knowing and trying to, I think in general, as humans, like trying to assume good motives can be a good, helpful place to start so that you don't feel when you go into these conversations that attack is imminent. Like assume that the supervisor cares, assume that the supervisor cares about you. Trying to start from that point as you engage in these conversations. And then the other thing is if the practicum supervisor is not a good fit, and that does happen. Like I've heard stories where
Oh,
that's
yeah.
just is not a good fit. I think the key would be then looking to your practicum liaison to find an additional outside supervisor who could help answer these questions, because these questions need to be asked. And if you're not comfortable, I have all these thoughts about, oh, we could do practicum matching, like we could have things like all sorts of ideas for how to make this easier and more smooth. But I think generally, though, being able to, you just need to be able to talk about it. And so some of my students were saying, hey, I could not talk about it with my supervisor. So I went outside to XYZ person, or I talked to my, teacher about it or my professor about it, So I think that's key. But I think regardless for both, and this is a point that I missed on the supervisor side that also applies to the student side. Keeping the why central. The why we talk about this is because we care about the clients. Because oftentimes when we get into ourselves, and this is just so easy to do, I'm
Helpful.
uncomfortable, so I'm not going to talk about it. And then if the why is your client on both sides, if we're coming together because we are on the same side of wanting to help our client, the conversation can be very productive if it's for the sake of the client. But when we start getting into our own, shells, it can be real, real, real uncomfortable. So.
And I think sometimes that that error, if you will, is when the supervisory relationship gets perceived as therapy rather than, professional development. And there, I would argue that obviously I think most people would, they're not the same thing. How about this, Bailey? How do you think, if at all, by the way, religious and spiritual topics in the context of supervision are unique from other kind of intimate or vulnerable topics that might arise in, field supervision? I'm thinking about race, gender, sexual or gender identity. I mean, pick one. But is religion and spirituality different in some ways?
I think this is a really great question. So, I think to start, spirituality and sexuality are really closely linked. And so, one of my colleagues who went to the University of Pittsburgh with me is studying sexuality. And we talked about how very closely interconnected spirituality and sexuality are. And I think, the thing, here's why. Spirituality and more so religion oftentimes are closely tied with morality and people's sense of right and wrong. And so it's human nature to want to be right and to not feel attacked by someone else or to feel like somebody else is judging you or judging your character. And so thinking about the worldview that we touched a little bit on, religion and spirituality to some degree like sets forth this worldview that informs people's moral compass. And so and before we go on any further, like I want to be clear that all of us like have this innate moral compass outside of religion. And so I've definitely witnessed how, witnessed that and seen that in a lot of my friends who don't necessarily hold a religious or spiritual perspective. And so that even the idea that someone doesn't hold a religious or spiritual perspective can be triggering for some folks, and can feel like an attack. And so I think when we, I think that's really what makes it really tricky. Because people can oftentimes then see this as rejection if people don't share the same views, and then people can then feel condemned. And I don't, I think religions try to address some of this, but we don't want to feel condemned ultimately. Like that's the real key. And we want to feel accepted and we want to feel cared for. And that's what makes this so tricky. Is when this kind of comes up against our sense of being accepted, cared for, and we all want to be in a place where we're doing what we think is right and feel right about ourselves.
Absolutely. And especially when it's done in the context of a relationship like we've been talking about, where there is a power differential, a grading component, and this is so-called a learning environment. So there's really a lot of reasons why I think people might want to quote play it safe, but ignore this kind of like really intimate and important piece of the whole story.
Definitely.
You know what? We're kind of starting to bump up against our time limit here, but before we move on, I think for many students the fear is real. I think for many supervisors the fear is real. I think for practitioners and academics, the fear is real. But if we keep it to supervisees and supervisors in field practicums, let's not ignore the fear. Are there real risks here?
That's a great question. And I think as we were talking, this is headed right to where I was hoping to head anyway. And thinking about students and what students can do to help facilitate these conversations, there is real religious trauma that folks have experienced and spiritual trauma that folks have experienced. And so in these conversations, there is always the potential for re-traumatization or traumatization as a byproduct of this conversation. At the same time, hopefully that's unlikely because the supervisor is going to be coming, the both supervisor and student are going to be coming with understanding and care and compassion and again modeling this like you said, this acceptance of the person and views don't have to be the same thing. And but I think that is a real key thing that we struggle with is I hold this view, therefore, if you disagree with my view, you disagree with me fundamentally. And so being able to hold that space for that person. I mean, I think also, I mean, the biggest thing is like dealing with that trauma. And so I really want to encourage students, if you have experienced religious trauma, and supervisors, go find someone to talk that through with, because that's going to really impact your ability to really help clients. So, and then so other risks, bad teaching and habits. If you're not talking, if the conversations are not going well, people can pick up bad habits and not necessarily know how to engage. And then definitely like misunderstandings and broken trust. And then that really can impact the way that folks are able to learn, because without that trust, it's really hard to learn. And so from the students that shared with me about really positive field practicum placement experiences, it was all about the trust. They trusted their supervisors. Their supervisors demonstrated that they were trustworthy based on how they taught and the ways that they, oftentimes it was about how they were teaching that made them, that helped build that trust and that relationship. It wasn't necessarily the personal disclosures per se. Personal disclosures were helpful. Some were sharing like, hey, my supervisor didn't share anything with me. I would like to know, one person said, I would like to know that my supervisor is a person. If they share their religious or spiritual positionality with me, that would mean that they're a person and not just a supervisor, And so I think there's a role for that as well.
For self-disclosure, do you mean? Is that what?
Yeah,
On the
yeah.
part of the field educator or the student, or, well, let's leave it at field educator.
Yes, for the instructor, I think it can be helpful. I think that is something that it depends on what and how those things are shared. A lot of my st so students had various opinions. They were, pretty much all over the map. Some, about a third were neutral. There's about, roughly a third that felt like, okay, well, it depends on what they share, if it could negatively impact it. And then, closer to a little bit over a third were like, hey, this would be great. I really would like to know that my su basically that, my supervisor has views. Like, it's good to know that they're a person, and how they're like incorporating their views. So I think how we do that can be, I'd love to like see some way that we could have, maybe a sheet that people fill out before they come in and meet with their instructors and say, hey, I would prefer this is how we do like this is how we dealt with it. Because for some, it really does like already start the triggering and traumatizing process to even know that they hold these views. On the other hand, I'm like, well, could we push against some of the stigma that they might be coming in with? Could this be a healing opportunity?
Well, actually, I have a follow-up question that is kind of related to this and maybe gives you more of a narrow lane to kind of talk about it. But as we get to the end here, I'm sure you've given some thought to like what schools of social work and their curriculums right? And their field handbooks, if you will, can do to foster, the kinds of positive relationships in practicum supervision that will, again, leave a lot of good space to include religion and spirituality. Do you have some thoughts or recommendations based on what you're hearing and doing?
Definitely. I think one of the key things is training. I think offering training for supervisors on how to ask the right questions and how to model this in their conversations with students, how to invite students into the conversation. I think oftentimes field instruct like practicum instructors already have a general picture of like, hey, this is, I mean, I'd hope that they have some pictures of like, here's how to be a decent human being, but at the same time, like just a good refresher, like it's always good to remind, be reminded of here students are paying attention and to let them know up front, students are paying attention. Here's some good questions you can ask. Here's some ways you can invite your student in. Remember that your student is going to be anxious to bring these things up. And so you are a big piece of facilitating this learning. At the same time, I think, and this is something that I think we touched on a little bit before in a previous conversation, the idea of being able to help, provide some accountability for our supervisors. Supervisors are often unpaid. And so that coming in, they're doing this out of their good own goodwill. And so if we were to do to even provide some extra benefits. I know some schools will give like discounted CEUs and stuff like that, but the more benefits that you can provide instructors, I think the better, because they are giving a lot of themselves. And so to have these kinds of
Oh, yeah.
conversations is really tricky, especially if they're uncomfortable with them. And so being able to do things to help to compensate them in some ways for the work that they're doing and to help value them well, I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle also. And so and then I have all sorts of dreams. I think it'd be really great
Oh,
to do.
dream on. Go ahead.
Oh, it'd be great. I think it would be really fun to expose students to different religious and/or spiritual like agencies, like to do little rotations, like have everybody do, a rotation in the, the Jewish Community Center rotation, like even if it's just a day, just shadowing and like maybe an Islamic, community center and maybe a Catholic Charities, for example. And like to give people exposure to the way that different religious organizations or spiritual organizations offer social services just as an educational thing. I think it could be really helpful. I would love to see I would love to see a matching process. I don't think that it's necessarily, it's one of those things that for example, it could be good to have both similar and different, supervisors that are similar and different to you. And even having exposure to two different supervisors, I think, I know that's kind of what we do with having two placements, but at the same time, I think it could be really helpful to, I mean, simultaneously maybe have a, second person that is similar to you and one that's different to you. Especially in this different areas of cultural competence that we look at, different positionalities. Because I think it could be really growing if students are open to growing in those areas. And then, I think being able to build and teach curiosity and cultural humility. Because ultimately, like the knowledge piece is not as much important because the important thing is, and I honestly think sometimes when students come in with knowledge about a specific religious and/or spiritual tradition, they're gonna it's easier to make assumptions about what that
Oh,
what
yeah.
people believe. And so being able to teach, regardless of what the religious or spiritual tradition is, how do you ask the questions about how this matters to the client themselves? And that's something that it's really not necessarily knowledge, but it's the questions of how the client, and in this case, between instructor and student, how the person themselves engages with the belief systems, that's really important. And I think that doesn't require any sort of degree in or religious or spiritual tradition, but that can be learned as part of the social work curriculum.
All right. Bailey, Thank you so much for joining us and talking about your work. It was really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Bailey Nichols for joining us today. The In Social Work podcast team is Steve Sturman, our tech and web guru, Ryan Trofe, our GA production assistant. Say hi, Ryan.
Hello.
And I'm Peter Sabota. Thanks for listening, and check out years of tasty episodes on our website. And we'll see you next time, everybody.